Go. Hello and welcome to Writer Mother Monster, which is streamed live on Facebook and YouTube and then released as an audio podcast on all major platforms. I'm your host, Lara Ehrlich, and before I introduce tonight's guest, I have a few exciting updates for you. Our official shop has everything from t-shirts and tea towels to onesies and undies, so you can support the show in style. And this Mother's Day, May 14th, treat yourself to a writing class with me, your host and the author of the story collection Animal Wife. We'll talk about writer motherhood, share strategies for prioritizing our craft, and write. You'll leave the workshop armed with a plan for recommitting to your creative work. Finally, a special thanks to our sponsors and patrons listed on the Writer Mother Monster website. Your support helps make the show possible. If you enjoy the episode, please consider becoming a patron or patroness to help keep the podcast going. For details on the store, class, and sponsorship, visit writermothermonster.com. Now, I'm excited to introduce tonight's guest, Elizabeth Nunez. Elizabeth emigrated from Trinidad to the U.S. at age 19. Winner of an American Book Award, an Independent Publishers Award, a Penn Josephine Miles Award, and a Hurston Wright Legacy Award, Elizabeth is the author of a memoir and 10 novels, four of which were selected as New York Times Editor's Choice. She is the co-founder, with John Oliver Killens, of the National Black Writers Conference and executive producer of the series Black Writers in America. She has served on the jury for national and international literary prizes and awards and is a distinguished professor at Hunter College, CUNY. She has one son, age 46, and two granddaughters, ages 15 and 22. And Elizabeth describes writer motherhood in three words as life-affirming, essential. Now please join me in welcoming Elizabeth.
Thank you so much, Laura. I'm delighted to be here and excited to be here.
Thank you.
This is a wonderful program you have. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you so much, and thank you for joining us. I am thrilled to have you. So let's start, Elizabeth, with those three words you use to describe writer motherhood and maybe also grandparenthood, which is life-affirming essential. Tell us about those words.
Life-affirming essential. It's essential to my identity. Being a mother is essential to my identity. It charts so much of what I do and how I think and how I'm still teaching. So it has a lot to do with how I deal with my students. It has a lot to do with how I deal with my son and my granddaughters. I think the danger of motherhood is that you put yourself behind. You don't put yourself first. And of course, we know that adage about, you know, on the airplane, put the mask on first. But as mothers, it's so hard to do that. So it's essential to who I am. I cannot imagine. I need not have biological children. I guess I feel that way every time I teach my students. They are my children. Yeah. You know, and I feel that. It makes me alive. Yeah. Makes me alive. It's also scary because it's a huge responsibility. And having gone through so many phases of my life already, I kind of know what's coming. And I know that I have to be very careful in terms of how I nurture and how I give advice to my students who I see as my children. To my own son and my grandchildren, because I know the influence.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. No, I think you're absolutely right. It does feel like such a huge, and it is a huge responsibility, as is writing and putting your words and your narrative out into the world, sort of similar to motherhood. So tell us a little bit about that side of things, about your writing and the responsibility you might feel there.
Well, I see myself as a storyteller. And I see myself as a storyteller in which I embedded in the story many things I feel very strongly about. So I don't necessarily begin with wanting to send a message or to tell someone what to do. I start with a story. I'm very oriented to that, letting my characters work through a plot. But I always find an occasion in my story, and it comes organically, so far so good, that things I feel very strongly about in it. I don't know if you want to segue into my latest novel.
Yes, please.
And I can say to you, for me, one can say my novel, my latest novel, Now Lila Knows. Can I show it to you?
Please do.
Okay. So I think it goes, how does it go?
Right. Yeah, it's a little tricky in this platform.
There we go. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's my latest novel. And it begins with the fatal shooting of a black man by the police in Vermont. And one would think that I'm writing that just because that's what's going on today. That may be true, but what I am interested in, what I'm using that story to say what I'm interested in, is what responsibility do any of us have when we see an injustice? Do we get involved? And of course, there's a price for getting involved. And of course, there are many, many, many excuses for us not to get involved. So I'm looking at the fact that we know, I mean, this has been said by Martin Luther King, it's been said by Elie Wiesel, that the only way that evil can prosper, can continue, is when good men, good women, say nothing and remain silent. However, it's not that easy to speak up. You know, to speak up is to engage yourself in something. So that's what I do. And that's in this story. There's just a jumping point to deal with a question I ask myself. I don't know if I will be brave enough. I hope I will be. And I just up the ante by saying, let me choose an immigrant. And an immigrant has every reason not to speak up because their position in America is tenuous. They have to be very careful, especially in today's climate that seems to be, against immigrants, against people wanting to come to America. And so what does that person also have a responsibility? Do you still, if you see something like that, I mean, my Lila in the novel actually witnessed the fatal shooting of this black professor by the police. And I choose to set that, and I'm always increasing the tension in a way, because I'm trying to find out, Elizabeth, the writer, is trying to get what the answer is. Yeah. And so I choose to set it in Vermont, which I understand is the whitest state in the country.
Yeah.
And so she has every reason not to upset the apple cart. She's a major minority in many ways. She's an immigrant. She's black. And she's in a place where it's not easy for her to do that.
Yeah.
So what does she do? You know, and so I write a novel to try to find out what does she do? You know?
Yeah.
I create a foil for her, which although it may seem it has to do with race, it really has to do with class. She comes from the upper middle class in her island, and so her fiancé, who's back home in the Caribbean, is an upper class guy. So basically what he tells her is, stay out of this. It's none of your business. You don't understand what goes on in America. You're new. You don't know what the relationship with. And of course, his only knowledge of African Americans is from CNN or MSNBC or Fox, from cable. And it's not a positive image. So that's the subtext. He's telling her to stay out of it. But I want to say that we are all humans in this. So regardless of what your color is or your race is or your class is, it's a human being who has been shot. And you are a human being that has a responsibility regarding an injustice. So that's it. That's that particular novel, Laura.
I can't wait to read that, Elizabeth. It sounds so powerful. I want to come back to the novel in a second, but let's sort of run with the immigrant story for a second. Tell us your own immigration story. So you emigrated here from Trinidad at 19. Tell us a little bit about your early life there and what that transition was like for you.
Well, the first thing that happened to me, things have changed. I have five sisters, and they tell me, and five sisters, and actually all five of my sisters are in the Caribbean. They have, at some point they lived in America, but they all went back. And they tell me that things have changed, that I'm wrong about saying, but at the time I was growing up, I didn't see any place for me as a woman, except to be a wife and a home, not just a wife, a homemaker. I wanted something else. I didn't know what it was, but I wanted something else. I didn't know what it was, meaning that I knew I loved reading. So it had something to do with reading and literature and whatever. So the first thing that happened to me is that I did get a scholarship to a small college in Wisconsin. Now, I'm doing some, I'm looking at this from the back to say I did not know at the present why I got that scholarship, but I can tell you why. I got that scholarship because the Civil Rights Bill had been signed, and it was a Catholic college, and I grew up with an Orthodox Catholic religion, but the Catholic colleges were segregated. They may not want to say it, but they were in fact segregated. So they were caught off guard when the Civil Rights Bill was passed. They were caught off guard that their colleges, if they looked at their colleges and universities, they were 90, 95, if not 100% white. So they began going into black countries in the Caribbean like mine, or in Africa, or in South America, trying to recruit students to bring to the college. This is in hindsight, I'm telling you, but it is in fact so. So when I arrived at that Catholic college in Wisconsin, I just couldn't believe it. It was just totally white. Not only the college was there, all the teachers were white. Not only that, the town. I didn't see any black people, except there were three other girls. Two of them came from Haiti, recruited just as I was. And one of them was from Trinidad, recruited just as I was. So we made up that. I was very uncomfortable during that time. The more I learned and the more I realized, that I was making up for somebody's conscience. And also, I realized that Milwaukee was not very far from where my college was. So they didn't have to go 3,000 miles to get me to integrate their college. They could have just gone 30 miles, which just shows the level of racism. So I quickly went back home. I remember when I took my last class, there was a taxi waiting for me. I jumped in the taxi and I went from there to the airport home. Because there's a bad feeling that you have when you you realize that you're serving somebody else's agenda. Yeah. That this looks like a gift, but it's not really a gift. It makes people be able to go to church, basically.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote a novel about that. My second novel was sort of about that. And I have to say, which is a good thing about the college, they recognized it, had me come back. They gave me a honorary doctorate. They celebrated it. So they admitted what, and they, the college is no longer like that. So anyhow, I go back home. I go back to Trinidad. Trinidad had just, was independent. But one of the things you know is you cannot have hundreds of years of colonialism ruled by the British and then declare you're independent and not think the influence would not be there. So they were neo-colonialists, if you want. And I found it difficult to get a teaching job. They were still having in this primarily black college, I mean, primarily black island. Trinidad is like 50% African based and 45% African heritage and 45% Indian, which has to do with slavery and indentured labor, and then everybody in between. So it's a combination of my being disgusted by the neocolonialism I saw there and my desire to have a bigger life. Now, I'll tell you something, Laura, that one more time in hindsight, and I did write about this. To get a green card, you know what a green card is.
Mm-hmm.
It allows you to stay in America and it allows you to work. And if you don't do anything bad within a couple of years, you can apply for citizenship. You're safe if you have a green. It's very difficult to get that. I got mine in 3 weeks.
Wow.
I just walked into the U.S. Embassy. The guy said to me, what do you want to do? I said, I want to teach. He asked me how much money you had in the bank. I had like $100 Trinidad dollars, which is like $30 U.S. He asked me, do you know where you're going to stay? I said, well, when I get a job, I'll find a place to stay. I had all the bad answers. He said, okay, come back in 2 weeks. I came back in 2 weeks. Bam, bam. He gave me a green card. Now, why did I get it? I just didn't think about it, or maybe I thought I was lucky or whatever. But the way things are related, I got that green card in 1968. I know you were an idea in the mind of the universe then. But do you know what happened in 1968?
Tell us.
Well, number one, Martin Luther King was assassinated. Number two, Robert Kennedy, who supported civil rights, was assassinated. But number three is that in 1965 the last immigration act that we have in this country was signed in 1965. And that immigration act was in fact a civil rights act. Because in 1964 was the civil rights bill which ended segregation. 1965, the Immigration Act ended quotas, ended country of origin as a criterion for immigration. And of course, before 1965, the favored country of origin was Northern Europe. After 1965, which is related to civil rights, and they removed country of origin, that's why we now had many, that's why you can just date people from Asia, people from Africa, people from Caribbean coming, because that was no longer a criteria. So to back up a bit. So when I went in the embassy, there were the two assassinations that happened, but there was also the fact that even though the act was passed in 65, the embassies didn't want to enforce it. Right? So it was there, but they weren't enforcing it. And since a lot of people didn't know about it, it remained. So when I went into the embassy, there was so many protests in America over the assassination of these two great men. In addition to which, there were protests on the Vietnam War, which again, you could not know. But let me tell you, Laura, which was stopped, is that every night, every single night, the news ended with this big airplane, a cargo airplane, and the back opened up like a big giant mouth, and out of it came body bags, one after the other, after the other. And what we knew, that there were kids in there. They were teenagers, and if they weren't teenagers, they were no more than 25. So I always say, I wonder why they don't still do that. Because that was the basis that hit people right away. Every time you're seeing it every night, every night, every night. And so it was a combination of the assassinations, the protests in the street, the fact that we were watching this every single night. Mm-hmm. And so that guy had a stack of, that guy in the embassy had a stack applications that he had not. So he was glad, in a way, he was glad to see me.
Yeah.
So he gave it to me. And then there began my journey in America. I never went back. I mean, I went back, you know, just for visits and so on.
Yeah.
But I made America my home. And so it's all tied to this novel. It took me so many years to deal with this topic. But it is that, you know, you think of the struggles that Americans have gone through. I mean, all the freedoms we have now did not come because somebody wanted to give it to us.
Right.
And it was young people like you who marched through the streets and changed it. And I was the beneficiary of that, especially the women's movement, which I must say I was very involved in. I was very involved in the women's movement. So I wanted to write a novel about our responsibility that we have to.
So tell me a little bit, because I'm struck by the fact that you left Trinidad for, as you said, a bigger life, a greater life, and you knew it had mm-hmm. something to do with words and literature and books. So when you made your home in the U.S., were you anticipating that you would become a mother as well as an author, or sort of when did the motherhood piece come in?
The motherhood piece was easy in that I just thought I would be a mother.
You always thought you'd be a mother? Or?
Yeah, it was not. I mean, I didn't think too hard about it. I just thought one day I'd be a mother. Of course, when it happened, it's a different story. And at the same time that was happening, I wanted to climb the professoriate. So I was in the midst of getting a PhD. And at the same time that was happening, I wanted to be a fiction writer.
Mm-hmm. Now tell us a little bit about all of those ambitions and how you, I've given up on asking how people balance that because I don't think there's a balance, but how did you navigate those ambitions, which all could potentially steal time from each other, right?
Well, yes, but I never let go of any of them.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just that the three of them were important to me. I will say that I remember that I was almost 9 months pregnant when I got my doctorate from NYU, when I said to my advisor, I'm ready to defend my dissertation. And he said, there's no way I'm bringing you into this room like this. There is no way that I'm going to do that. So instead of graduating in June, I graduated in January because after I had my son in the summer, I came back in the fall to defend my dissertation. What I say to my students, because that is the position I'm in now, is that if you have this dream, I know a lot of people like to take a leave or a gap or stay away. I said, just keep on doing it. You don't have to do a lot of any of it. There were times I had to, I only took one course. There were other things happening. But I always get scared that if you let go any part of this, it's very hard to get back on the train track. So I would do things like, and to this day, I still do it. I say to myself, I can write 500 words a day. I can do that. And I won't say I write 500 words a day for 7 days in the week. Let me say I can do that in 4 days in a week. Well, 4 times 5 is 2,000 words in a week, which is a lot.
Yeah.
Because if you multiply that, you can have a first draft of a novel in the same 9 months it takes to have a baby. Okay, you can't do 500. Maybe you can do 150. But the point is, you do. Even if it's half an hour. Even if, because writing is a dream, a long dream. If you break that dream, it's hard to reconnect to that dream. So even if it's on the train, on the subway, I tell my students, oh, I just came to teach, but you know how much I wrote on the train? You know, it's just scribbling, you know, you're just in it. So that, having my son, being a mother and definitely being a grandmother, it just brightens my life. It makes that not, I just don't know how to say it. I didn't see a conflict. I didn't see a conflict. I felt that there was just, when I was teaching, or I don't know if you could do this today, but I had my son's, the seat that you put in the car, but not necessarily, on my desk. You know, my students just had to get accustomed to it. Yeah. He couldn't walk. He was a few months old. He was on my desk. If he cried, I had to deal with it. But so as a result, in the first college I taught was at Med Gavis College. I was there for a very long time. And everybody knew my son. They know him. Because they knew him as a baby. They knew him as a toddler. They knew him, you know, they knew him. They knew him as a teenager. They knew him when he went to college because he was part of my life.
Yeah.
So it sounds daunting, but it isn't daunting. You don't have to do a lot of all of it. And also because the motherhood only has a certain time. The writing does not have a certain time. And the degrees do not have a certain time. Okay, so you can do that in little itsy bitsy pieces. You can't do that with motherhood because what do the Jesuits say? They say, give me a child until he's 7 and he's mine for life. Hmm. So that is your priority in the early years. But I never let go of the other ones.
I love that. I love rethinking what it means to write during especially that period, that writing, and we've talked about this a lot on this show before, but writing doesn't have to be sitting for 5 hours and writing, the whole Hemingway model. So I love writing can just be on the train for 15 minutes.
That's correct. The point is, the point that I believe is that you don't ever let it go. Because it's hard to go back.
Mm-hmm.
And one, it's hard to go back. And number two, one helps. Yeah. Here's something I do when I'm walking. We have all these devices now. And I don't like walking with anyone, which is, you know, people kind of, they say hi to you and they want to walk with you because I am reading, I'm talking my notes.
I do that too. I love that.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's writing. You're writing. You get back to your house and you basically have a framework or maybe even a whole scene. So, it's daunting, but it's not impossible and it's not a chore. How about that?
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, that's exactly, that's a perfect message. Mm-hmm. And tell us about your son. Has he read your work?
Well, no. He claims that he knows me too well and he would be self-conscious reading.
Yeah,
what I
that's
write.
Fair.
Especially if it has any kind of love or sex in it.
Yeah.
And also, I think, and this is a stereotype I'm making here, but I think that generally men think that fiction is for girls or for feminine, you know, made up stories. What they don't realize is that some of the most essential truths are in stories.
Yeah.
And that it's story that changes the world. It's story, right? So lately he has begun to start to read fiction. So I'd say in the last 5 years, he's been an avid reader of fiction. And he actually recently sent me a quote from all places, Bloomberg. Where some business person was saying just what I just said, that it's the story that makes a difference. It's the story because story connects with you emotionally. And as much as we would like to think that the brain, the intellect, has more control over what we do, it's our emotions.
I think that's a great segue into a little bit of your work. If you'd like to read us from whichever of your books you choose, few minutes.
Well, Laura, I could have done whichever books, but I sort of thought I'd read from the most recent.
Absolutely, and I'm going to give you the full screen, so I'll disappear for a second, but I'll come back when you're
okay. Well, wait. So I'm going to do about 2 or 3 minutes, right?
Sure.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
Take it away.
Yeah. So in this scene, the black professor at the college, because college only had 3 black professors and one of them was killed by the police. But the other two don't tell Lila that she should be a witness. They don't put that pressure on her, but the expectation is there. So in this scene, Lila sees Terrence, who is one of the professors. She sees him walking down the corridor. He says, sit, sit. He opens his office and has her come in, and he says, sit, sit. He pointed to the chair facing his desk. He says, I shouldn't have talked that way to you, saying it's not your fight. I know racism doesn't only happen in America. What I meant was, he sat down and shoved away a pile of papers in front of him. But this is our country, Lila. We have to solve our problems. African Americans have to take a lead. There was an intensity in his voice that compelled Lila to make an admission she had not planned. I saw when that policeman shot Professor Brown, she said. In an instant, Terence's face darkened and rows of thin wavelets crossed his forehead. He pressed his hands on his desk and bent towards her. His shoulders raised, the muscles on his neck strained. Did you tell this to anyone? He asked. I told it to Robert. Robert? My fiance, she said, back home. Are you going to report what you saw? I'm not sure it would help, she said. They, the police, may not put too much worth in what I have to say. And why is that, Lila? I'm here only as a visitor, and what, Lila? And I can't be sure. Of what you saw? Her fingers twitched nervously. If she reported what she believed she saw, she would have to go to court as a witness. She would need a lawyer, and she did not have money for that. And what would be the worth of her word against the word of an American officer of the law? She was here at the pleasure and goodwill of the U.S. government. It was the U.S. government that had granted the college permission to hire her. Her work permit could be yanked. She could be sent back home. She knew Terence was waiting for her answer. She looked down on her hands. She could not bear the glare from his eyes. But you did see, right, Lila? His eyes were still fixed on her. You said you saw. I said I saw when it happened. I cannot be sure I saw what happened. Terence threw back his head and laughed. It was a laugh without humor, a sad, accusatory laugh, a fine distinction, but a distinction all right between when and what. But I don't blame you, Lila. Like I said, this is not your problem. You can go back to your sunny island. We live here. We have to face the racism here. I wanted you to know, she said softly. To know what? That Professor Brown was innocent. Terence laughed again. My dear West Indian girl, you do not have to tell us that. We know. We have decades, hundreds of years of knowing. The police are always right. Black men like Ron are always wrong, always guilty in their eyes. He began gathering his books and papers on his desk. I have to go. Those students, he pointed to the door. I told them I'll meet them in the library. He was dismissing her. But his condescension had irked her too. My dear West Indian girl, he said. He let her leave first, standing back politely at his office door to let her pass through, and then he walked away in the opposite direction. He was angry with her. She could hear his footsteps clacking noisily down the hallway, and perhaps she had given him reason to be condescending. She was a coward. She had squirmed her way out of taking a stand with her simpering when and what. And yet she had legitimate excuse. Sensible reasons for not committing herself to any statement that would implicate her as a witness, that would invalidate the police's claim, accuse him of lying. This was not her country. She could be deported. So I will stop here, Laura.
Thank you. That was beautiful.
Thank you.
And I think a wonderful segue, actually, to social justice and to talk. I know we talked about that a little bit, but let's turn to some of your work in that area. So again, from your bio, you co-founded the National Black Writers Conference and you're the executive producer of Black Writers in America. Tell us a little bit about those two organizations and just your work sort of generally. Why? I mean, it's a basic question probably, but I'll ask it anyway. Why is it important to lift up other Black writers?
Okay, so as I look at my own trajectory in life, I probably started as a little selfish person, just concerned about myself. I moved on to being a reader. I moved on to being a writer, to be a teacher, etc., etc. I'm still not, and this is why this novel is so important to me, because I'm testing myself. Still not involved. I'm very much I call myself a literary activist. Because I know many Black writers. What people don't necessarily understand is that publishing is a business. And it's a business that needs a market. Needs people who purchase for the business. So what is happening is that there are Black writers who are not getting published because the publishing company says, who's going to buy it? There is no market. Now, publishers seem to think that the only people who would be interested in books by Black writers are white people. And sometimes white people express that. They say, I want to read stories that have to do with my experience. Well, for heaven's sakes, it has to do with your experience. It has to do with your experience as a human being. Number one, it has to do with your shared experience as a human being. And number two, the only way we end isms is when we see ourselves in the other. So, Laura, it is unfortunate that some Black writers do not put their photographs on the cover page, on the cover of their books. And they tell me that that's how they sell. Because, so I kind of took a chance because, number one, my photograph is there. And number two, the cover of my book, clearly with that picture, it tells you I'm talking about the experience of a Black woman. And yet, I saw myself in books by white writers. I loved Jane Austen. Mm-hmm. From the time I was 12 years old, I have been reading Jane Austen over and over and over. I can tell you all those novels. I used to be called Betty when I was a child. And when I read Elizabeth Bennet in Pride and Prejudice, no, I wanted to be like her. I didn't see that I was a Black girl and she was a white girl. I saw someone who was independent, someone who was courageous, someone who said, I'm not going to sell myself for money. I'm not going to just marry just anybody because I don't love them just because it will get me out of my financial situation. Of course, part of the reason why you read the novel is all ends up well. She gets the handsome rich man. But the point is, as a Black girl, it spoke to me. I'm identifying with Elizabeth Bennet. I'm hating all the bad people in the novels. I see the unfairness of the treatment of women. I see how women have to, you know, of course, in those days, it's because they had no other way of employment. But today, it's still the same. It's not a heck of a lot different. It's a lot different, but not majorly. Yeah. So if I could do that through a book by a Black writer, why can't a white reader do the same thing from a book by me? But unfortunately, publishers know they don't buy the books. So Laura, that is what is, I had no idea that you were white, to tell you the truth, although I could have looked at your last name and known that you were. But it's amazing what you're doing. You're giving me a platform here. And here you are, a white woman, giving this Black writer a platform. You're basically saying to your audience, to your readers, that what I write about should be relevant to their lives. Mm-hmm. And you're basically saying to your readers that my characters are human beings just like you are, regardless of the color of your skin. And then you're saying something else, that the only way we're going to change the world is when we see ourselves in people who are not like us. Because when we see ourselves in people who are not like us, all the prejudices fade away. Mm. They fade away, you know? Because you say, oh my God, this is a person who's just like me.
Yeah.
Who has the same dreams and whatever. So my activism with the National Black Writers Conference and Black is kind of giving Black people a platform. At the time, I thought that's all I have to do. I don't think so today. Mm. I thought all I had to do is to give them a visibility and a platform. And now I feel, no, it's more than that. I have to say to white readers that you are censoring me.
Yeah.
You are censoring me. Because a publisher may love my work. But if I don't have what they call the numbers, they're not going to publish it. So you are censoring me. And I want white readers to be aware of that.
Yeah.
So it's not just So it wasn't so, you know, the Black Writers Conference and Black you know, I wanted people to know there were writers, but these writers are not getting published now. And you can't blame the publisher, because I tell you the truth. If Red Jello was selling, they'd publish Red Jello. So that's where I am now in my evolution. I think that, okay, you know, publishers are just businessmen.
Yeah.
It's true what they are selling is crucial. It's about values. It's about vision. It's about human history. It's a big thing that they are selling. Nonetheless, they have a bottom line. And so the problem, and then I was kind of doing some mathematics. Black people are only 12% of the country. So if publishers are only targeting black readers, they will never become a bestseller.
Mm-hmm.
Just plain math. They will never, never. And so what you are seeing, or what I observe, is that there are some black writers who are getting the attention, but when you look at why they're getting the attention, is they have a white godmother or white godfather.
Mm.
So I feel very strongly about that. I did an interview not long ago, and I asked the interviewer this question, which I can ask you. If a tree falls in the forest, you know, the tree falls in the forest, and nobody hears it, why? So I'm making an analogy to writing.
Mm-hmm.
I've written nothing in the book, and nobody hears it. But the tree did fall, right? The book was in fact written.
Mm-hmm.
So why did no one hear the tree fall?
Mm.
Why did no one hear about the book? So actually, I'm curious to ask you.
Yeah.
How come you found out about me?
Well, first of all, I am a voracious reader and I read everyone,
mm-hmm.
sort of regardless of skin color or background, or maybe because of skin color and background sometimes, mm-hmm. like you said, looking for mm-hmm. experiences outside my own to see myself yeah. reflected and to expand my personhood, my humanity in that way.
Mm-hmm.
And then you and I were also at a conference together where you were faculty and I was a fellow and I heard you read.
Where was that?
That was at Breadloaf over the summer.
Oh, yes. When I did that thing about Jane Austen.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Yep. And so I don't know. We didn't really talk because I am outside of this space, nervous about approaching people I admire, but I admire you and I wanted to talk with you about all of these things that we're talking about now. So I guess in answer to your question about the tree, I think sometimes you have to go looking for the silent tree, right? And standing. Sorry?
What makes you look? You're exceptional. Okay? So because I said publishing is a business.
Yeah.
What's going to direct someone to looking?
Yeah. That is a very good question. I don't know the answer to that question. I don't know. I would hope that maybe it comes from underneath, right? Instead of top down, if the publishers aren't going to change the industry.
You're correct.
Is it people like us who need to change it? Readers
that's
who
you're
need
correct.
To? Yeah. So you tell me.
Well, I think that we just have to take some responsibility for that.
Yeah.
And I think that, I got invited to the Brattleboro Book Festival in Vermont.
Mm-hmm.
And probably in a million years, I wouldn't have been invited. But I got invited because my book is set in Vermont and there was some curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
So, they lined me up to read with I'm not going to name the person, but I guess an important bestseller. Anyhow, they had me read in this cavernous place, huge, and the place was packed. So when I walked in, I said, my God, they're not here for me. Who would know me? And because there were probably just two people of color in that whole room, I said they would not know me. And I didn't know the person either. Some, you know, he's had his books made into movies and that kind of thing. That kind of guy.
Sure.
Anyhow, when I read, this is about the tree falling. They discussed my book. They were very enthusiastic. So what usually happens when you finish read, you know, they have this table and you line up, and I just prime myself to the fact that if I'm reading with a white writer, especially a white writer who has some exposure, I'm going to, you know, I just get ready that there my line would be three people who just happy, you know, want to say something, but this will be round and round. But it was the opposite, Lara. Absolutely the opposite. Not only that, within 15 minutes, all my books were sold. Number one, they didn't anticipate that. But there were quite a few books, but we would have sold many more books, right? But that's the tree falling. They didn't know. So I'm going to give the readers a pass. And I'm also giving the reader, the publishers a cynical pass. I'm saying there's somebody in between.
Yes.
That has to direct the readers, that has to direct them that the tree is there. And so what did it? You know, it was this, okay, this is a novel set in Vermont and we're about to have a conference. Let's ask the person who did it. But once they directed me there, people said, oh, that tree fell. So I'm in a stage where, as I said, my cynical view of the publisher is not really cynical. That's what they do. You know, they write you these nice letters. We love your book, but it's not a right fit for us.
Mm-hmm.
Translation, we don't know the market. We don't know who's going to buy the book. That's absolutely what it means.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So that's their little corner. And the other corner that I have more positive to say is I think there are many readers, people who are readers would be receptive to hearing other voices. I don't think that there is racism in their attitude towards reading. I think they would be receptive. So who's going to direct them there? As far as the publishers are concerned, they feel that their safe space is white middle-aged women. Mm-hmm. So they're not going to direct the traffic to black writers because they think they wouldn't sell. But they haven't tried.
Yeah.
I don't think they're going to try. I always keep saying we need somebody in between. We need somebody. We need some kind of. And I'm afraid, Lara, it's not black people. It's going to be white readers.
Now, do you think the people in between might be booksellers or podcast hosts or me, people who are readers and have a platform to share with other readers?
That's correct.
Yeah.
You're absolutely right. So that's why I asked you. I mean, I didn't spend too much time, I'm afraid. I just assumed you'd be black.
Really? That's so interesting.
Because that's how it happens.
Mm-hmm.
So here is a white woman who is saying, I want you to come on my program to talk about your book.
Yeah.
So what you're doing is you're saying to readers, there's a novel by a black writer that I think may be of interest to you. Or at least you're just letting them know it exists. Huh?
Both. Yeah.
But at a minimum, you are letting them know it exists.
Right.
So, Yeah, I think that's the answer. To put it in another way, Black writers need godfathers and godmothers. Yeah. And unfortunately, the godmothers and godfathers are white, and simply because doing the math. So I find myself doing something I never did before, because I would read with these very important writers, and I just, you know, I guess I think I was as important as they are, and leave the scene. But now I am more intentional. I go to them and I say to them, listen, I need you to promote me. I'm just straight off. And they respond. They could blurb me. I have a very good friend who's a Black woman who's an excellent writer. And she tells me, oh, I need blurbs by white writers. Mm. It's sad.
Yeah.
It's sad, but I know what she's saying.
So tell me a little bit more for a second. Let's stay on that about asking. So tell me how you approach because I feel like maybe this is controversial for some, but the white middle-aged man whose books are made into movies has had his time, right? Like that, sure. But how do you feel about that person needing to be a godfather for work that is, in my opinion, more powerful, more vital, more necessary now? It makes me angry to think that voices like yours even would need a godparent to.
It makes me angry too. It makes me angry too.
Yeah.
Because Lara, I sit on so many awards committee.
Right. Tell us about this. Okay.
You know, I know why I sit on awards committee. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons is just plain diversity.
Yeah.
But I'm not knocking the fact that I'm also a good writer. Mm-hmm. And I read books and I say to myself, my God, you know. So it does make me angry. It does make me sad. I don't despair. This is a new me. A few years ago, I probably would, just as I said to you, I sit on committees with some major writers and editors, and then I just do my work and I leave. Mm-hmm. Lately, I'm not doing that. I am telling them what the problem is. And I am saying to them, and the problem with the arts, as you know, regardless what the arts are, is very competitive. Not everybody gets in. So I know nobody wants to share the limelight with anyone else. I understand that. But I'm saying you have a responsibility. You have power to open a door that I don't have. Mm-hmm. And don't pretend you don't.
Yeah.
Don't pretend you don't have that power. So people get the impression that all the stories by Black people are about a certain socioeconomic class. They are girlfriend books of a certain social economic. There's a lot of cursing and body ripping and all kinds of, because they think those are the books that this audience of Black read. So I need someone to open my door. You know, I'm not talking about me anymore, really. I'm talking about all the writers I know, all the Black writers I know who are really good writers. And one of the things I also do is I say to an audience, I want you to put up all your 10 fingers, and then I want you to name the Black writers you know. And very rarely can they cover one hand. Very rarely can they cover one hand. Now, that ought to bother somebody.
Right. Yeah.
That ought to bother somebody. So I say to white writers, do not pretend that you do not have power. You may not think it's right that you should have power. I don't think it's right either. But the fact is you do have it. Yeah. And I don't. And you have the power to open a door that I don't. So I've been, you know, I've been working on this for decades. And this is where I am in my career, you know. I said something very sad, and I just think about how sad it was. When you saw me at Bread Loaf was the second time. So I'd done it the year before. And this particular woman who was in my workshop, she liked what I had to tell her, and she was thanking me and praising me and all kinds of stuff. And I said to her, you know, you have a better chance of getting your book published than I do. Mm-hmm. And she said, why? She was shocked. And I said, because you're a white woman. Mm-hmm. I was very sad. I remember that because it was the first time I had articulated something like that. This was a woman in her 50s, so she wasn't, you know, she wasn't, I probably wouldn't have said it to someone younger. And she realized what I said. But it was sad for me to have to say, hey, I'm the teacher teaching you, and I'm telling you this. So that's it, Lara. You're doing a big deal. What you're doing is important.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. As is your work, Elizabeth. And I think you are leading people to the tree. And I can only only try to do the same. So we're in it together, and I will promise to you that I will lead as many people to the trees as I possibly can. And thank you so much for joining us. It's been my pleasure to have you.
Very sweet of you. Thank you so much. I hope I didn't talk.
That's the point. You're the guest. Thank you, Elizabeth. And I hope you'll come back with the next book.
Sure, I will. Okay. Take care. Bye-bye.
And thank you all for joining us this evening as well. If this episode resonated with you as much as it did with me, please go out and buy Elizabeth's book and her 10, 11 other books as well. And lift up other writers, other Black writers, other writers of color, anyone different from yourself. Let's make that change happen together. So thank you all, and I will see you next time.